desperate mother, but one that could become almost mythic. I made up the boatwrights, building them from scraps of family story, but deepening them with music and a wry spoken language that layered incident and terrible details to create something not unlike those mountain songs I had heard as a girl. Tragic, awful stories full of powerful, broken people. I had learned a resilient, matter-of-fact approach to my childhood from the early women's movement. I had learned how important it was to be frank about rape and violation, self-hatred and shame. My knowledge was hard won, and it had taken me years to figure out how to stand in a room with people who knew my story and not collapse or try to hide or to lie. But that was separate from the stories I wrote. I might not have ever had the courage to write those stories without that experience, that training ground in how to look at one's own life and see it as a story. But thinking about the grim and painful things I had experienced in the real made me more appreciative of the books and stories I had read that rescued characters from that reality. What I loved were books that heightened the sense of life's wonders without denying the complexity and horror that sometimes accompanied those wonders. I loved books that showed women and men surviving what seemed almost impossible to survive, and coming out the other side with a sense of worth that redeemed suffering and grief. Memoir did not seem to me to be able to shape in that direction the way I wanted the story to shape, at least not any memoir I could write. If a story is about a well-told lie, then that seemed to me what I needed. I didn't need to hold my mother up to ridicule or condemnation. I understood too much about the decisions she had been forced to make to keep her girls alive. I thought her life a tragic, painful story, a lesson in why the women's movement and rape counseling and battered women shelters were so vital. I wanted the world to have been different for her. I wanted it to be different for women who came after her, me and my sisters and all my cousins, and for all those I thought of as my tribe, raped children, working-class girls, and those raised to both love and hate their own as I had been. Years later, when prevailing winds of the media culture shifted from fiction to memoir, some writers were eager to make their novels and stories over into autobiographical accounts. I found myself both horrified and enraged. Did they not know what they were doing? The damage done to a communal sense of what was truth and what was fiction unnerved me. It was not only that false biographies tended to overshadow true ones. They obscured a hard fact that all fiction writers know, which is simply that real life is far less believable than fiction. That is, in fact, part of the power of nonfiction narratives. To take details from real life into fiction and make them believable requires careful work. Creating characters the reader can believe would do the unbelievable, and setting up a scene where those events make some kind of sense. The shorthand of nonfiction does not require that work. One just keeps saying, "But this is true, this really happened." I found myself questioning that assumption, and finding out that, in fact, the truth in some of these accounts was false. But there were others so well written that I found myself believing them, and feeling a grotesque sense of betrayal when the books were revealed to be fiction. There is a difference between fiction and nonfiction deeper than technique or intention. I value both, but genuinely believe that fiction can tell a larger truth. I have built my life on what I learned in books that took me inside characters whose struggles and dilemmas revealed intricate and astonishing things about human character. I have no doubt that some of those novels were based in part on the author's experiences or real lives, but by moving the narrative over to fiction, the author took on the responsibility of fully imagining a world separate from the perspective of one person's experience. Asking what if and answering that question is the bedrock of what the novel can achieve. The story becomes something more than one person's perspective. It reaches as far as the novelist can imagine. For me, none of these issues were purely intellectual. I had spent years trying to be carefully frank about the difference between my life and the fiction I created. I knew how important it was for me personally to tell the truth about my childhood and my family. Even all the ways I had messed up and caused myself further damage in sorting out the impact of violence and self-hatred. I knew, too, how important it was that we have a sense of what people's lives were genuinely like, all of us who got caught in the gears of family violence. The mythology of rape and child abuse had done me so much damage. People from families like mine, southern working poor with high rates of illegitimacy and all too many relatives who have spent time in jail. We are the people who are seen as the class who does not care for their children, for whom rape and abuse and violence are the norm. That such assumptions are false, that the rich are just as likely to abuse their children as the poor, and that Southerners do not have a monopoly on either violence or illegitimacy, are realities that are difficult to get people to recognize. The myths are so strong they subvert sociological data and personal accounts. I remember reading Gone with the Wind when I was 11 years old, and recognizing with painful clarity that those dirty white trash slatteries from whom Scarlett O'Hara's mother caught the fever that killed her were exactly the figures that my family were supposed to represent. That was a fiction, but I am always running headlong into people for whom that family is part of how they see people like me and those I love. I want the society in which I live to be clear about the reality of our families, to know all the ways in which we avoid the issues of violence, abuse, and societal contempt, and to see survivors as more than victims. If we know more about what it means to survive abuse, we will be better able to help those still caught in the whole shameful secret world of physical and sexual violence. No lies, I thought, but lots of stories. True stories, true lies, powerful stories, heroic tales, and cautionary fables. Stories open the door to the darkened room. Language can carry us past the horror to the sense of purpose in a life that refuses to surrender to that darkness. In that gymnasium in Maine, I heard people speak about their horror, the horror that their children would be told stories they did not want them to know. I understood too much of that. The desire to inhabit a world in which terrible things do not happen, and therefore do not have to be explained. I want a world in which no child goes hungry, fearful, or ashamed. I want a world in which families are treasured, no matter how poor or how much the object of scandal. But I looked into faces smoothed by fortune and respect, as well as faces as rough-hewn as my own uncles and aunts, and I saw all over again what comes of pretending that terrible things do not happen. Shame comes with denial. Fear fattens on lies. The man who told me I told his story had not stood up to speak when the meeting was taking place. He had waited 2 hours to speak those words and leave. The teenagers I met with privately had been plainly frightened that people would learn their secrets, the bruises and terrible curses they had endured. They wanted me to write more stories, to make sense of what did not make sense. But they were not writers. They were people trying to live their lives without having to go naked for others the way it seemed I had chosen to do. It is 20 years since the publication of the book I wrote, almost 18 after the court case in Maine that upheld the school board's right to block the use of some books in the high schools. We lost the case. We lost the ACLU appeal. After the last ruling, Stephen King and his wife, Tabitha King, bought copies of Bastard Out of Carolina for many of the libraries in the state, a gesture I appreciated more than I could ever express. It seemed to me that countering censorship with the free and open distribution of the novel was the best response possible to all that had happened. But it did not address my grief, or the loss of a dedicated teacher, or the reinforcement of the silence and anger I saw in that man's face when he came up to me after the town hall meeting in Framingham. Books can offer a counter-narrative, another story to the one we think we know. Story is told in a voice. The voice of Bastard Out of Carolina is that of a young girl who has just lost her mother and her sense of any real hope or justice. You don't know who she is until the story ends, and I always intended for the ending to make the reader angry. In the writing, I had thought that if I get this right, I can change so much. How people think about rape and child abuse and working-class families and the nature of resilience, and even perhaps something about how love can both save us and not save us. But also in the writing, I had thought that there was no way to get anything that right. All I could really do was tell a story the best way I could, and hope to nudge some people's notions a little more toward understanding what still does not make sense. Why would anyone beat a child? Why would anyone rape a child? Older and full of the world's experiences as I am, I still do not know the answer to those questions. Oh, I understand the psychology of hurt and desperate characters. I understand how people can make terrible choices in situations in which they feel powerless and full of rage. I understand all too much about self-hatred and violence, and how the cycles of violence are handed down in families rich and poor, urban and rural, and in every region. No one has a monopoly on horror. Many of us can tell terrible stories that barely hide the origins of our understanding. The kinds of stories that are unbelievable without a newspaper clipping or a video on YouTube. What banning books does is continue the denial, extend that damage, and block any way for us to come together and address the reality of violence within our families and communities. We know this, even as we go on wanting a world in which we do not need to tell these stories at all. Last year, another school board, this one just down the highway from my home in Northern California, voted to ban the use of Bastard Out of Carolina in the schools of Fremont. I was in Colorado teaching a workshop when a reporter called me to get my response on the case. I stood there feeling again that weak helplessness I had felt in Maine. I knew I could not say what I was feeling, say, "This breaks my heart," and hang up the phone. I had to take a deep breath and try to be reasonable and respectful, and pretend I was not feeling what I was feeling. Grief. What I feel every time I encounter censorship is grief and shame and despair. And not just when it is my book that is the subject of the matter. I have felt it with every book I have seen become the target of such actions. Books that I think literally helped save my life. Such as Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye or Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. But also books that scare parents and challenge teachers and librarians to have to answer the questions of young people encountering the issues of violence or sex or prejudice and hatred in such visceral, intimate terms. For that is, of course, what it means to read a novel and live in it for a while. You are viscerally inside someone else's reality. You feel and understand things you have not known before, and that is both scary and exhilarating. The world becomes more clear, reality more vivid, and your own experience larger. Of course, there will be questions. This probing is how we grow and enlarge our sense of the world itself. As I said, there are books I worried about my son reading, books I would hesitate to let him pick up. But my hope is that with any book he reads, he could come to me with his questions. Then I could take that deeper breath I have learned is vital, to give me time to think and be patient. And then we could talk. I would hope that I would be able to be in the room with him, in any book, and not censor what he might read or think. I would hope for the largeness of vision that reading many, many books has given him. The ability to take in complicated ideas and painful feelings, and sort out what is true and not true, and what might be true and terrible, but vital to understanding the world in which we all live. I do not want to be the person who acts always out of fear or denial or old shame and older assumptions. I want to be my best self. The one who set out to tell a story that might make a difference in the lives of people who read it. Unafraid, stubborn, resilient, and capable of enormous compassion. Someone like Bone. This has been an Audible Inc. production of Bastard Out of Carolina, written by Dorothy Allison, narrated by Elizabeth Evans. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 1992 by Dorothy Allison. Production copyright 2012 by Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.